Mark Mayhew is a licensed clinical social worker. He does a lot of community work with vulnerable populations in Indianapolis, Indiana, alongside some private practice work after hours. And one of the specialty areas he's experienced in is religious trauma. He's been treating clients who have survived this specific type of trauma for a while and on purpose. He knows what it's like to be in their shoes. Here's his story.
If I'm being completely honest, it goes back to when I was about 14. There was a confluence of events. There were three factors that kind of hit me. Any one of them would have been challenging, but because they all happened about the same time and were interrelated in some ways, and those three things, I was diagnosed with severe scoliosis and needed surgery. My oldest brother had gotten a college hookup pregnant, and I was an extremely devout Catholic. And those things kind of intertwined, also because when this happened, I was 14. I had just become aware of how amazing boobs are. But I also knew that premarital sex is sin. And well, my brother got his hookup pregnant. See, he's ruined his life because of premarital sex. And I have scoliosis so bad I need surgery. I'm a twisted freak. And those things, they kind of knotted together. And the result was, in my teens and 20s, I did almost no dating. I didn't think that I should reproduce. I thought that if I do get married, then, you know, it would take some conviction to get me married, because marriage is for reproduction and I don't think I should reproduce because I am blah, blah, blah. That caused me to kind of check out from having a real life. It's like I spent my teens and 20s watching people have lives. And one of the primary drivers of that was, you know, I've got these urges to do all these fun things, but I shouldn't do them because I'm not married and I shouldn't be getting married. So I'll just kind of sit on the sidelines and I will watch lives that I can't live.
So it sounds like a lot of the messaging in your head that was dysfunctional, or feels now like it was dysfunctional, was around like sex and sexuality. Do you have any theory as to why you believed that so strongly at the time, when maybe others hearing the same message didn't latch on in that way?
Well, I had received a sex ed course through our church that consisted mostly of making us look at close-up, full-color photos of genitalia with advanced venereal diseases on them, like advanced. So, you know, the first vagina I ever actually saw was covered with infected blisters. So that was part of my sex ed. And so that is, to me, why the sexual component was so deep.
How old were you at that point?
I think I was 13. Yeah.
So right.
In hindsight, I'm thinking a little old to be getting, you know, any sort of sex ed.
But at a very important developmental peak, I would say.
Yeah.
Of starting to understand and want to understand sex and sexuality. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how interesting, if that's not the right word, but unfortunate, impactful experiences like that can be, you know, in a way you look back at and think, how could adults think that was the right approach?
Well, they still do, though.
You think?
Yeah, yeah, I know. My family still goes to that church.
My name is Tobin Richardson. I'm a counselor educator with the vision to save the therapist by creating a forever free podcast style platform designed for learning. Here, digging into the topic of religious trauma. And although we all likely have done at least some trauma work and can envision how this might apply to religious experiences specifically, I think it might be helpful to begin here with just some examples that might include things like growing up in an environment that used fear-based teachings to control behavior, or where questioning beliefs was met with punishment, or where a person is taught to suppress their authentic self, or it may be something like sexual abuse by a religious leader. And healing from religious trauma can be an especially long process, and it's, of course, deeply personal. But, of course, there are best practices. It's possible to heal, and clinicians who uniquely understand how to support clients in this type of circumstance. And one of them is Anna Clark Miller, who's a therapist and trainer who offers education and tools for survivors of religious trauma. She wrote a book called The Religious Trauma Survivor Guide and gets how intricate and complex this work can be. Here she is.
When I think of religious trauma, I think it's might just be hard for clinicians to navigate in their head. When is it religious trauma versus when is it just a religion that I don't understand or I wouldn't adhere to? What's the difference, I guess, if you can just define religious trauma?
Yeah. Well, so I'll define religious trauma, and then I definitely want to respond to what the question about, like, how do you tell the difference between regular trauma? But so my definition of religious trauma is that it's a complex physiological response to adverse religious experiences where a group's ideology, practices, or power structures undermine the individual's safety and autonomy. And so if you are familiar with, like, complex PTSD, religious trauma is going to look really, really similar to that. In fact, there's a reason why there's not like a DSM diagnosis for religious or spiritual trauma, because honestly, the like symptoms are really, they're just trauma symptoms. But just like we would, you know, specify maybe the type of trauma that someone has experienced and sort of have a more detailed conceptualization of what that trauma is like because of the context. Religious trauma is a topic where it's important to know what created those trauma responses, because it's unique in a lot of ways. It has a lot to do with belief systems about the world and about yourself that are unique to religion and spirituality. There's a lot of suppression that comes along with high control religious or spiritual groups. And those are all really unique factors that need to be considered even if you are a really experienced trauma therapist. There are some nuances there that are important to be familiar with. Deconstruction is a term that a lot of folks who are exiting or have exited a, you know, controlling religious group, that's a term that they'll use. And the idea there is that they're sort of like approaching these really rigid beliefs with a stance of curiosity for the first time. And it's not about sort of like trying to reject or accept a belief system as a whole, but instead like pick one belief at a time and examine that and sort of like compare that with your own core values. And I think a lot of folks that are feeling desperate in high control religious groups, they're noticing that their core values are not actually aligning with the things that they're being taught and the things that they're experiencing. And so that process of differentiating from the group is so important to eventually leaving and then healing from all, you know, the indoctrination or just the ingrained sort of trauma responses that come from all of those confusing core beliefs. And if you've ever worked with someone who's been in, say, like a domestic violence type of situation, the process of raising awareness to the abusive system and differentiating from that person, and then eventually, you know, exiting and recovering from all of that power and control, that process really closely mirrors the experience of someone who's recovering from religious trauma. If you kind of think about the cycle of abuse, it's like there's this pattern of escalation, reconciliation, and then honeymoon period. But usually when someone's trying to break out of a cycle of abuse, they're realizing, hey, I want to quit reconciling and quit like trying to chase that honeymoon period when like I can't put up with the way this is impacting my mind and body. And so a big event like, you know, getting publicly humiliated by the group or getting kicked out of the group or, you know, maybe having your experience of abuse be totally minimized. Those are definitely things that can be a big catalyst for somebody to say, hang on, I need to address this.
Can you talk more about that term high control religious or spiritual group? What does that look like? Like, how do you know if a group is high control?
Essentially, a high control group is, it doesn't necessarily mean that the leaders are setting out to just exploit people and that's their only goal, right? But usually it's that they believe in their ideology to a point that it's less important to consider the experience of an individual than it is to promote the ideology. And usually that looks like some sort of threat that coerces the members of the group into conforming and into submitting to leadership. There's also usually some sort of like spiritual authority that's involved that intimidates group members into not questioning and sort of saying, well, you must be right because, you know, you speak for God or, you know, what have you. And then a lot of the control that happens in these groups comes in the form of shame and isolation. So, you know, telling people, hey, your nature is fundamentally bad and we have the answer to that problem, that is a control tactic at its core. And so naturally, people who are in a group where they're being told to conform and to suppress parts of them that don't conform and to sort of sacrifice their well-being for the group, they're going to experience trauma. That's a situation of terror and helplessness that is a perfect recipe for trauma responses. Yes. But yeah, high control groups, I think, is a way to specify the circumstances in which this kind of trauma could occur without necessarily labeling all religious groups or all spiritual practices as abusive.
Can you talk more about symptomology specifically of religious trauma, what that might look like?
Absolutely. So a lot of people have, you know, contributed different like frameworks to what the symptoms are. And so my sort of synthesis of that, it falls into five different categories. So there's anxiety, which, you know, can look like intense fear about the afterlife or fear of being judged by peers or by God. The second category is shame, that feeling of I'm inadequate or my nature is bad, and I deserve punishment. The third one is rigid thinking. And, you know, essentially that's here's the correct way to believe. a lot of like binary thinking of things are either good or bad. The next category is self-suppression. And that's sort of when the group suppression is internalized and the individual says, I'm not going to let my identity or my emotions step outside the bounds of what I've been told is allowed. And then the last category of impact is unhealthy social patterns. So as you would expect, especially in a really tight-knit, closed kind of group, there are a lot of social dysfunctional patterns that get really normalized, and survivors will often recreate those in other places, even if they've left a high control group. So those are kind of the main categories of symptoms. And of course, there's a lot of specifics within those that are unique to each particular group and their beliefs and stuff like that.
But yeah. I imagine in with this specialization, this is like something you come up against a lot, is people wondering if you're this like villainizing religion. I don't even know what my question is here, except for like, how do you navigate that with your specialty?
That is a really big challenge in working with this specialty, because I think a lot of people, naturally, we have a lot of biases when it comes to our spiritual beliefs. And it's really hard to sort of just suspend that wherever you are on the spectrum of whether you're religious or not. And so I do think there are some people in this field that are very anti-religion. And that makes it really inaccessible for people who do have religious beliefs, but also want to figure out how to recover from adverse experiences. But I think it's important to recognize the fact that there are a lot of really supportive and positive groups out there that share, you know, faith-based beliefs, but they don't have the rigid dogma that sort of edges out any kind of diversity or any kind of experience that doesn't align with their, you know, desired public persona. And so it's really important to recognize not every religious group is toxic. However, just like not every relationship is toxic, we do want to be aware of the red flags, and we do want to know how to prevent a group from becoming toxic, even if it's inadvertent. And so I like to, whenever I facilitate a training on religious trauma, I like to start with a statement about religious neutrality, where my purpose and our purpose as a, you know, licensed therapist who is required to be as unbiased as we can, our job is not to impose any sort of pro or anti-religious message. In fact, it would be really ironic if you are a survivor of religious trauma to try to indoctrinate someone out of religion. So like, indoctrination is not the point. That's not the point at all. And so the idea is we want to talk about the power and control dynamics, not about the group or, you know, the ideals themselves that drive any particular, you know, ideology.
I'm curious if this work lends itself well to group work, maybe like couples or group work, or is the vast majority of your work at the individual level?
I do actually think it can be like used in a group setting really effectively, because there's so much invalidation and gaslighting in a high control group that when you get in a support group of survivors, you can actually say, this was my experience, and have that, and not have somebody tell you that you just need to pray more, or, you know, like whatever sort of spiritual bypass you would have gotten before. The one risk I see, though, with group work is sort of a recreation of some of the group tactics that really encourage oversharing and sort of like a confession aspect where without your true consent, you're being forced to sort of overshare your deepest, darkest secrets and open yourself to judgment. And that can sort of echo an unsafe feeling that they might have experienced in their past group. So that's just something to be aware of if you are facilitating a religious trauma support group.
What are ways, like, just knowing how important community is and like mental health functioning, are there ways that you found through for a person who may have lost that community if they're beginning that deconstruction process? Are there suggestions you have to really like help them build that back? Do people sort of need like a break from that to do some introspective work before they try to jump back into another community?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think, again, that's one of those that it's like, it really depends on the person. It really depends on how high control their group is, you know, but, Judith Herman's book on trauma and recovery, one of the first stage that she talks about of like beginning to heal from trauma is establishing safety. And when it comes to religious trauma, I would add autonomy. So establishing safety and autonomy are sort of like the foundation. And for a lot of people, if they're having a nervous system response when they're in their religious community, it's really hard to establish safety and autonomy. And so I would say a majority of folks who are really ready to dig in to recovery are going to need to get some kind of distance just to learn what it feels like in their body to have safety and have autonomy. Because then they can, if they want to, go back to the group and engage in, you know, different practices or traditions and see if it feels like that safety is being threatened. But it's really hard to kind of be all in and do that differentiating process of like really understanding subjective experiences if you're really saturated in a group.
What are there any lessons that you've learned since you've started doing this work that you wish you could go back to your former self and say, like, you had this wrong, you know this instead?
Oh my gosh, yes, yes. So a little like self-disclosure, I grew up in what I would consider a cult. I was a missionary kid overseas. And even, you know, continued in pretty high control religious groups into early adulthood. And so my entire developmental years were founded in very rigid thinking. And so something that I have had to learn first, just as a therapist, but especially as a religious trauma therapist, is the importance of curiosity and non-judgment, because it is such a second nature instinct for my brain and for, I would say, most people who in their developmental years were raised in a high control group. It's so second nature to immediately judge as something being good or bad or healthy or unhealthy or right or wrong. And it's impossible to try and help somebody else recover from long-term indoctrination if you as a therapist are not even realizing those major biases coming up. And so when I'm working with a client, I'm often having a lot of like gut reactions to the stories they're telling. And I'm constantly sort of reminding myself to slow down and to be curious and to encourage the client to be curious. And so I think that's the thing that, man, if I had known that in my teen years, that would have, it would have created some really uncomfortable situations, but I think it would have been great. But it's also been a liberating experience just personally and professionally to really lean into that.
Yeah. Gosh, thank you for sharing that story. I think something that often gets overlooked for clinicians is like that we all are humans that have our own biases and triggers. And I always am so grateful when a clinician like admits that, you know, because how easy is it to not do that? No matter what side of the spectrum you fall on any issue, we should be acknowledging that like,
yeah,
leaning into curiosity is never a bad thing rather than jumping.
Yeah. Well, and not believing that you have biases is a sure sign that you do have them. So yeah, the more we can acknowledge those and like actually try and manage them instead of deny them, I think that makes us better clinicians.
Is there anything else that we didn't get to that if you are just listening to a piece on religious trauma, you're like, yeah, I think this is something the average clinician should know more about?
I think something that is so important to explore if you are working with religious trauma or cult recovery is to address the shame, the underlying beliefs about self that are just so baked in, but may not be immediately obvious to the client. There's a lot of overworking and overserving, a lot of fawn responses that are common in this population. And all of those are founded on shame. And so if there's one thing that you talk about with your clients, it's to ask and be curious about their core beliefs about themselves, even if their behaviors from the outside might look like perfectionism or, you know, something else that looks really high functioning.
One of the major principles I'm walking away from this piece better understanding is that religious trauma is complex and it's multidimensional. It's important to recognize that a person's relationship with religion can deeply affect their identity and their worldview along with their mental health. Like with all trauma, it can manifest in a lot of different types of symptoms. And they can be psychological, like depression or anxiety, or emotional, like feeling worthless, or spiritual, like a loss in their faith altogether, or existential despair, or it can be physical, like sleep disturbances. For many clients, part of healing from religious trauma involves redefining or rebuilding their spirituality in a way that really feels authentic to them. And as a therapist, you can support them in that by exploring spiritual practices that align with their values and beliefs, or maybe even rejecting spirituality altogether if that's what feels right for them, or by identifying a personal sense of meaning or purpose or connection to the world that's separate from rigid religious frameworks. And another thing you can do when working with religious trauma is just to keep trauma-informed practices in mind. So one of which is to consider the window of tolerance. And when a client's ready to talk about their trauma directly, keep in mind the principles of choice and agency and safety and empowerment, things that are fundamental clinical skills that you probably already have developed and can just lean into in a way that creates an environment that builds real trust.